This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, the anthrax threat is spreading while the FBI warns that another terrorist attack may be coming. Are we winning or losing the war at home? First, we take you to a city that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services considers a national model of emergency preparedness. Long before September 11th, officials in San Jose, California, had been getting ready for any disaster, including a biological or chemical attack. I spoke earlier with Frances Edwards Winslow, San Jose's Director of Emergency Services. She explained why San Jose is ahead of the game.
Well, we were fortunate in 1997 to be included in the first group of cities in the Domestic Preparedness Program, and it enabled six of the federal agencies to come to the assistance of the largest cities in the United States and help us to anticipate what the threats might be in our community and what would be the most appropriate way for us to be trained and equipped to respond to them. And so we were able to move rather quickly through the planning process because it was a joint effort.
A lot of us have heard about the airline confetti incident. We know now it was a false alarm, but can you tell us what happened and how your department was able to respond?
In this case, someone suggested that anthrax had been released on an airplane at our airport. So it began with a fire response. The hazardous materials team that have level A suits were able to go aboard the plane and investigate and collect some of the material.
Are those the white moon suits we've seen in pictures?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The level A suit protects the respiratory splash and vapor. Mm-hmm. And so dressed like that, they went aboard the plane. And the material that they picked up was clearly plastic hearts and stars. So this level of concern dropped significantly once they saw what the material was. But the fire department nevertheless took the individual who was suggested to have been the cause of it and the woman who was the witness and escorted them off the plane. The fire department went through the decontamination process, and then both of the individuals were interviewed. During this time, the other 80 passengers and the crew had to stay on the airplane until it was determined whether they could possibly have been contaminated or not. And, of course, fortunately,
it was just confetti. But what does it take in terms of equipment and expenditure on training for a city to be up and ready to respond to the extent that San Jose is?
Well, at the present time, we've received a total of $1.4 million in federal funds to help us develop our cache of equipment, pharmaceuticals, protective gear for our personnel, and communications resources. And in addition to that, the city has spent millions of dollars paying for overtime for our staff members to take the appropriate training and then have refresher training so that these seldom used skills remain usable for the personnel at the time that they may need them.
Before September 11th, you were already deeply engaged in this. What led San Jose to make such a commitment to preparedness with all the budgetary constraints on cities today?
San Jose is the capital of the Silicon Valley. We have high-tech industry here. We have a lot of hazardous material permit holders in the community. And so as we worked with the FBI and the Department of Health and Human Services to look at our community, it became clear to us why they had some of the concerns they had, and we certainly shared them. And so our mayor and council acknowledged the importance to the city of joining this effort and making it a part of our preparedness.
All this week, we've been urged by the Attorney General and head of the FBI to be on high alert that the threat of a new terrorist attack is significant and real. Today, for example, what's the profile of San Jose's readiness and preparedness?
Well, really, since September the 11th, we've maintained a much higher level of vigilance and preparedness. Our surveillance level throughout the community has been raised. And we have also invited our community members to join us. You may remember some years ago there was a push for something called Neighborhood Watch, which was crime prevention based on folks in the neighborhood who knew the neighborhood working in partnership with the police department. And we're encouraging our residents to join us again in exactly that same way and let us know if they see activity that doesn't seem right to them, if there are materials left around in the community that don't belong, if they see people loitering in odd places, that they become our extra eyes and ears and let the police and fire department know what their concerns are.
When you look across the country, what percentage of American cities do you think have this kind of level of preparedness that San Jose has today as a result of federal help and your focus?
Well, I believe that our partners in the original 27 city group are almost all at about the same point that we are. And then in addition, there are a total now of 50 cities who are within the planning process. And I'm sure that all of them are very conscientious in applying all of the knowledge that they have and the equipment that they have to making their communities as disaster resistant as they possibly can.
So with all this training and focus and expenditure, how do you feel when you look at the threat level and San Jose's vulnerability today in light of the great creativity and disregard for life that we've seen evidenced on September 11th?
Preparedness for a terrorist attack is not a station. It's a journey. I have no idea what challenges might face my community in the next days or weeks or years. And so all I can say is that as we gain knowledge, as we receive information from our federal partners, we constantly reevaluate our plan, we exercise on a regular basis with our staff members, and it is our goal and our hope that if the time should come when we would have to respond, that the efforts that we've made would allow us to save lives.
Frances Edwards Winslow is the Director of Emergency Preparedness for San Jose, California. I spoke to her earlier today. A fourth person died today of inhalation anthrax. As the contamination spreads beyond postal workers, government employees, and journalists, so do the questions about fighting terrorism on the home front. We've got a new director of Homeland Security, but other than regular press briefings, what is Tom Ridge doing to make Americans safer? Beyond vague warnings, how are the FBI and the White House protecting Americans from another terrorist attack? Is the government organized to succeed? Joining us now is Ernest May. He's professor of history at Harvard University. He's been a consultant to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He's co-author of Thinking in Time, Uses of History for Decision Makers. Good evening, Professor May.
Good evening.
Thanks for being here. Are you feeling confident in our security effort on the home front? Are you hunkering down for Halloween or trick-or-treating as usual? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Professor Ernest May, you've written and studied security issues for a long, long time. You know the history of this backwards and forwards. With an eye to history, what do you think of the new Office of Homeland Security? Is it structured in a way that will make it effective?
It's very hard to tell at this moment. It's created by an executive order. Its powers are uncertain under that executive order. Governor Ridge, the director of the office, has the general mandate to deal with Homeland Security. He is given under the executive order a council, which is a little bit like the National Security Council, except that it includes also a lot of people who are heads of domestic agencies. Mm-hmm. Had its first meeting the other day. Exactly what he will be able to do is very hard to tell. I think that the model that Governor Ridge and President Bush should follow is the model of the Office of War Mobilization in World War II.
Back to 1943 or so.
It was 1943. And it's not that the problem is an identical problem, but it's generically it is. The problem in 1943 was that we were at war in Europe and the Pacific, and we were not doing very well. Mm-hmm. We were holding our own in the Pacific, just barely making progress in North Africa and the Mediterranean. We had huge resources to bring to bear, but we couldn't get them together. We couldn't get the rubber to make the tires. We'd had airplane engines in one place and aircraft bodies in another mm-hmm. place. We had literally scores of agencies that were doing different things, that were working at cross purposes.
So what was the government's response then? Was it similar to the response we've had today? How did people try to attack this?
Well, what was done initially was to set up a variety of different agencies which simply became other competitors along with cabinet mm-hmm. departments. Mm-hmm. The Office of War Mobilization, OWM, was set up in 1943 to really make this coherent. And the key to it was that its head, Governor Ridge's counterpart,
okay.
was former Senator James Burns mm-hmm. of South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And Roosevelt issued an executive order, Franklin Roosevelt, issued an executive order which said that Burns was to have the mandate to create both policies and programs mm-hmm. for war mobilization, that he could issue directives to cabinet departments and agencies, And those agencies were commanded to follow the directives. And this was accompanied by a letter from Roosevelt saying to Burns, there is no appeal from your rulings. You are, for practical purposes, assistant president.
This was not what the then-Senator Harry Truman proposed.
No, that's right. At the time, Truman proposed, and many people in Congress were supporting, the creation of a super department for war mobilization. Exactly as many of, indeed, the most thoughtful members of the Senate and House today are talking in those terms, of a super department of Homeland Defense. Mm-hmm. But Roosevelt perceived that that was not the solution that would really work, and I don't think it's a solution that would really work now. That's one of the reasons why I think OWM is the model.
So which is the RIDGE, the Homeland Security Office model, the Truman proposal or the FDR proposal?
Oh, I think ideally it's what FDR did. It depends on the extent to which he's given the power to do the job.
But it really relies on the power and him, as FDR said to James Burns, there is no appeal from decisions you make. You are the power.
And exercising it, as RIDGE obviously can on the basis of his background. He was a very effective member of the House, a very effective governor.
And very close to President George
Bush. Very close to President Bush. And he has the capacity to bring people together. Now, that's what the person has to do. He has to have the power in the end to crack a whip. But he can't crack a whip every hour. He has to get people around a table, get them to agree what's really important. What have we got to do now?
Mm-hmm.
Who is most able to do it? Which part of the government should have the lead on this? And are the rest of you willing to let that element of the government have the people and the money that it needs to get that job done? Then will Congress consent to that?
From your vantage in Cambridge so far, how is RIDGE doing?
Well, it's just started. It really, he had the first meeting of this Homeland Defense Council, which is like what Burns did. Burns got together cabinet heads and agency heads. He had them sit around a table. He wouldn't deal with number two people. He would only deal with cabinet officers or with agency heads. And then he put those questions to them. What do you think is the most important issue? What do we have to do right away?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I hope that's the kind of approach that Governor Ridge is taking.
Professor Ernest May, how do you see the challenge that the United States faces now, this terrorist threat, compared to the threat the country faced in World War II in terms of the requirements of Homeland Security needed in response?
Well, the threat is not really comparable in the sense that we were fighting a war on two fronts. There wasn't really much question in 1943 that we were ultimately going to win that war, but it was a question of how long it would take, how many lives it would require. Here we're at a disadvantage because we know we have applicable resources, but I don't think we have any reason to be absolutely confident we're going to win.
And why is that?
Because it's a new kind of enemy, because the capacity of the enemy to attack us at vulnerable places is great, because we are in many ways domestically more vulnerable. And in World War II, we were not attacked at home. We were fighting a war abroad. The question was getting our resources together to fight there.
How do you marshal resources against terrorism? It's not like getting rubber for tires together, as in the World War II challenge.
Well, some of it is. Some of it is getting human resources together. Mm-hmm. That is, if you take the biological terrorism, which anthrax is the current example, you apply to that a combination of research capabilities, of the capacity to produce vaccines or remedies of one kind or another, the hospital capabilities, that we have
public
those
health
capabilities, but you have to be able to get them together, and you have to have people exchanging information in a very a system that's spread out all over the country and that does not have cooperation built into it.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't have it yet.
That's right.
We're going to have more.
Right.
We're talking with Professor Ernest May. He's professor of history at the Kennedy School of Government and of American History at Harvard University. He's been a consultant to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He's co-author of Thinking in Time, Uses of History for Decision Makers. Our topic is Homeland Security. We're just 6 weeks into this new terrain, and so far we're not feeling very secure. How fast can we expect a new level of security? What should we expect in terms of structure and power from the new office and Tom Ridge, who's at its head? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How secure do you feel tonight? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.
from Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Yesterday, the new U.S. Homeland Security Director, Tom Ridge, explained to reporters why officials warned Americans of an impending terrorist attack.
Everybody has a heightened sense of alert. We send a signal not only to America, but those who would terrorize us, those who are trying to disrupt our way of life, that we are on guard as a country. Some people have questioned, well, you put us on a general alert a couple of weeks ago and nothing happened. Well, we will never know if the country going on alert, heightening security, thwarted or frustrated an attempt by somebody or some individuals within this country to bring harm or terror to a community or to a region.
That was U.S. Director of Homeland Security Thomas Ridge. We're joined this evening by Professor Ernest May, Professor of History at the Kennedy School of Government, and an academic with deep insight into security and how it can be structured for success, the history of security efforts in wartime in the United States. How secure do you feel tonight? How do you think we're doing in the early innings here of the war on terrorism on the home front? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Professor Ernest May, what about the information flow so far? It seems that that's been a critical element, and you've no doubt looked at how that's worked in other conflicts. There are a lot of press conferences going on. There's been some stiff criticism out of Washington that they haven't been well coordinated, that the message hasn't been clear, that the facts haven't always been delivered in a straight way. How would you assess the administration's efforts so far at information flow to the public about the threats that the country faces?
Well, on the whole, not very good. It's partly because it is fragmented. People take the initiative in one department or another. I think myself that it is a mistake for Governor Ridge to make pronouncements about the state of alert or about anthrax or any other such subjects. That is, I think he should be focused on coordinating the machinery and helping on behalf of the president to select people who are going to take the lead. Now, that means, I think, in the present instance, designating somebody who takes the lead in explaining to the public and to the Congress what's going on, say, in the bioterrorism area. Possibly it's the Surgeon General, possibly it's the head of CDC, but it ought to be one person.
And not Tom Ridge.
Not Tom Ridge.
Because?
Because in the first place, he can't be an expert on this. He shouldn't be an expert. He should not be spending his time trying to understand exactly what the level of fineness of the anthrax is. And that's somebody else's business. Mm-hmm. His job is to get people to decide who's best able to deal with this problem and to agree on who should have that responsibility.
And doesn't he also risk being turned into a kind of high-paid, high-ranking press officer?
That's right. Absolutely. And it's also important, I think it's part of the discipline that needs to be exercised, is that it has to be made clear that other people, that somebody is a spokesperson on a particular threat area, and other people should keep their mouths shut. Mm.
Ernest May, what's your assessment of overall how the government's doing so far, and how do you feel about the picture ahead?
Well, they're just getting things together. It's just really begun, and it's an enormously difficult job. And it's going to be very painful for all of us. In the first place, we are at war, and we are very likely to have other very serious incidents. I don't take this current warning at all lightly. Remember that the World Trade Center attack was almost certainly planned at least in the mid-late 1990s. Mm-hmm. Preparations went on for a very long time, mm-hmm. the training of people mm-hmm. to do it. There's no question that other projects of that kind began to be developed in the same period. We're facing not something that's improvised after September 11, but something that's been in the works for a long time.
I've heard you say that it's not a bad record so far, but the next big terrorist hit may be the thing that really tests.
That's correct. Yes, we managed to cope wonderfully with that awful event in New York on 9/11. Mm-hmm. The level of concern about anthrax, the level of publicity about the anthrax threat has certainly exceeded the magnitude of the injury to the country. Mm-hmm. But we're dealing with it very sensibly. But if you imagine any of a number of contingencies, it's not clear that we have, especially if it's not localized, especially if it's not centered in San Jose, the place where you were talking with, mm-hmm. getting some very good testimony from. If it's spread around, for example, to take one awful possibility, somebody communicates smallpox to a plane load of passengers who are mm-hmm. going to various parts of the country, mm-hmm. and you start to get something like an epidemic, and you don't know exactly where it's going to come. Suppose that there's a serious attack on our rail system, the capacity to move food, to move medical supplies, mm-hmm. Coincident with something like that. Mm-hmm. And I said a moment ago that it's going to be very painful. That's partly because of this need to set priorities, and because that means we say this is the threat on which we've got to concentrate next. That mm-hmm. means that there's another threat that we're not going to deal with for a little time down the road.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about U.S. Homeland Security and how it's going in the early innings of this new war on terrorism. We're speaking with Professor Ernest May from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. You can join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. Connor is on the line. Welcome, Connor.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm a 30-year-old, born and bred person from Ireland, was based in Dublin, living in the States for the last 6 years.
All right.
The Irish people have, you know, have sort of gone through something like this in the South for a very long time, where every morning we'd wake up and hear about something that was going to happen, and we became numb to the fact. But our generation basically lived through it and kept on moving. And one of the superb things about living in the States, it was the optimism that everything could be overcome and we could move on and become better and better people. And mm-hmm. that's one thing that that I would hope that would keep on going, keep on being articulated through the media and from everybody, that whatever is to happen, and obviously I agree with the professor that something is more than likely going to happen at some point, but we have to keep on living.
Connor, it's a wonderful point. Let me put it to Professor Ernest May from historical perspective. How do you think we're doing in terms of psychological state right now? And thanks for your call, Connor. Psychological state, and how do you keep up that, what Connor calls that optimism, that joy in living, when these blows or just the psychological pressure stretches out?
Well, so far it's been quite wonderful, really. Indeed, mm-hmm. the response of the public in general, and of course the New York public in particular, has been really
inspiring stuff.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. quite extraordinary. My wife and I went down to New York on a train company. It happened that we were with some firemen, Massachusetts firemen, who were going down for a ceremony there. And I can't remember when I felt so warmed by the kind of patriotism that I heard. But let me make just one point, and I think it is true that we can learn a lot from looking at the experience of people in Ireland, people in Israel, of living with the threat of terrorism for a long period of time. But it's also true that what happened at the World Trade Center is different from what has happened in those countries.
In what respect?
Well, in the first place, because it's not based on any sort of negotiable demand. It's not to express sympathy with one side or the other. But
it's just an attack, take it or leave it, there it is.
It is true that the IRA was asking for something. Mm-hmm. These people are not, there. It's not clear that there's
not
a
clearly.
Way in which you stop it. The scale of it, the willingness to destroy life on the scale of the World Trade Center is not unprecedented, but it is awful. And it suggests that we face threats that really don't have clear boundaries to them.
Those are both big differences. I want to bring in another guest right now,
sure.
if we could. We're going to be joined by Dana Milbank. He's White House correspondent for The Washington Post, has been covering the developments with the Bush administration and the early days of the Homeland Security Office. Dana Milbank, are you there?
I am. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
Give us a sense, if you would, Dana Milbank, of the Washington perspective. You've described an authority vacuum and a reputation for Keystone Cops that's developed in these early days. What's the perception around Washington of how the White House is handling the war effort so far, and how is it getting situated to handle worst threats or knocks down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I did use words like Keystone Cops in some of the communications aspect of this. My overall impression is that that things are going along rather well, particularly when you consider the unprecedented nature of the threat we have right now. So there have been a lot of, it's been very unclear who's speaking for the government now. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of contradictory information coming from different branches of government and different officials within the different branches of government. And we've been shown to be woefully unprepared even for this sort of outbreak, let alone what's conceivably a much worse one to come.
So what's the latest in the gelling, I guess, of new security efforts? Are they gelling? Are they pulling together?
The problem with answering that is you only really know when something actually happens. I mean, first of all, in the intelligence area, you only hear about it when it's a failure. We don't know what they've been able to thwart from happening. In the response area, in the public health, that sort of area, we won't know until there is a much larger outbreak to know whether they've really learned a lesson of how to contain this. But I think in many ways we've been lucky. It's hard to call ourselves lucky at this moment, but lucky that this is the sort of thing that's mm-hmm. only involved maybe a couple of dozen infections, four deaths so far, because it is jolting us to prepare for the smallpox, the nuclear strike, the massive chemical strike, which is a completely different order of magnitude, but at least we're now preparing.
It's a warm-up.
It is, and I think it was very encouraging news that Thompson and Ridge have talked about getting a smallpox vaccine for the entire population.
How about the Office of Homeland Security? How is its role emerging? We've been talking with historian Ernest May here, who points out in World War II, FDR gave James Byrne sort of carte blanche, really large power to do. He said, there will be no appeal from your decisions, James Byrne. Mm-hmm. Does Tom Ridge have anything like that kind of power now?
Well, that's actually, I think, the ideal model. What a lot of folks in Congress are talking about, giving Ridge more statutory authority as his own cabinet agency. But in fact, if you see the way the modern presidency operates, and in this one in particular, the power does not reside in the cabinet agencies. It resides almost exclusively in the White House. So in theory, what Tom Ridge has, being 10 or 15 paces away from the Oval Office and the freedom to enter it whenever he wants, is all the power he needs. Now, it remains to be seen what actually happens. He has a lot of other very powerful players there, and it's not clear. Now, John Ashcroft at Justice has been a very strong figure. Tommy Thompson at Health and Human Services has been probably the weakest in the response so far. You can see in a little bit in the body language, in the actual language, they're yielding a bit of authority now to Ridge, mm-hmm. but it's a developing thing. It's been only 3 or 4 weeks now.
Dana Milbeck, we have a lot of callers who want to join us. If you'll hang with us for a second, let's bring them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking about the early days of new homeland security efforts. Keith is on the line. Welcome, Keith.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
What I'd like to ask both the guests to speak to is I don't know if it's the danger we run, but we keep highlighting in our stories some of our weaknesses. In this show tonight, the professor mentioned someone hitting the railways. We saw there's been a lot of talk about smallpox and the lack of vaccination. Mm-hmm. How do we weigh or deal with the public's need to know some of these weaknesses and the fact that we may be highlighting great targets for the terrorists?
Keith, thanks for your question. Ernest May, let us ask you first, what about this balance between the public's need to know and the media's duty to lay out what the situation is, and the sense that in doing that we may actually be giving people ideas? Is it a legitimate fear and concern? Or,
well, it is a legitimate concern, and I think that though the margin is it is a problem at the margin rather than at the center.
How do you think the U.S. media has done in this current crisis?
I think they're doing pretty well, but let me just address mm-hmm. Keith raises a very good question, mm-hmm. but one point I would make to him is a point I was making a moment or two ago. You have to think that things of serious magnitude take a certain amount of planning effort. They're not improvised. Mm-hmm. That means that the information that's in the media now about vulnerabilities that we have is may be something that feeds into a plan for something that will happen in 2005, mm-hmm. but it's not going to create in itself an immediate vulnerability. What's important is that we be aware of that. What's important is that, again, go back. If you go back and look at the newspapers and magazines in the United States in the period when the World Trade Center affair was planned, mm-hmm. they're full of the TWA 800
mm-hmm.
story,
right.
just full of stories about airport security, about the ways in which airlines are prepared to deal with hijackers, all kinds of information.
Are you suggesting that was a guidebook for the terrorists who planned?
Yes, it was very helpful to them. I don't mean that it should not have been published, but I think what it illustrates is that our people who were thinking about counterterrorism probably did not read those stories with nearly the attentiveness that the terrorists did. And to have people who are thinking about terrorists also think about our domestic vulnerabilities is an important intelligence issue.
Take us back to World War II for a second. Was the press any less full of stories about our vulnerabilities? Was there a clampdown on that?
To some degree, there was a degree of censorship. That was not that problem. And the press, what had happened was that the press had been full of backbiting stories. And indeed, the editors and reporters were tired by 1943 of hearing one cabinet member complain about another.
Government infighting.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So they were pleased that Burns took this job. And just one little thing, Roosevelt also sent a letter around to cabinet officers saying that any cabinet officer who complained of a ruling by Burns and did so to the press should also at the same time submit his letter of resignation.
Dana Milbank, what about in Washington? Is the press corps there feeling pressure not to write what it knows? Are you getting kickback from the Bush administration that the press is saying too much or not?
Virtually none of that. There's a huge perception out there in the public that we're giving away some information that is somehow helping the enemy. What I think people don't realize is that we do check very carefully with the government about what we're releasing and what we're not releasing. Although the public has had plenty of complaints, the government has had virtually no complaints. And I think what the government realizes that the general public may not realize is the level of sophistication of these terrorists. So, I mean, for us to be reporting that our chemical plants are not particularly secure is certainly not any news to Osama bin Laden. They know a great deal more about this. Perhaps they know more about these vulnerabilities than our own government does, as we've seen recently. So there's virtually no cases in which we are providing information that could be helping a terrorist.
Dana Milbank, thank you very much for joining us this hour. Dana Milbank is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. We're talking about U.S. Homeland Security. 6 weeks on from the launching of the new office with Tom Ridge at its helm, how are we doing? How secure do you feel? How confident do you feel that the government is taking the steps it needs to take to make the homeland secure? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255, or online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR, Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the state of Homeland Security 6 weeks after the launching of the Office of Homeland Security under Tom Ridge. How are you feeling? There's a lot of talk about anthrax. Our guest tonight, Professor Ernest May, professor of history at the Kinley School of Government, says that may be no bigger than the West Nile virus threat. Yet it feels magnified in the wake of September 11th and in the full knowledge and explicit warning that we may face much greater terrorist threats still to come. How do you feel tonight? Are you feeling safe? Do you feel the government's doing what it ought to do? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can join us. Tony is on the line right now. Welcome, Tony. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you. I'm more interested. We can all on Halloween evening think of ghoulish things that can happen on all fronts. I'm more interested in directing your thoughts and conversation towards emergency preparedness actions that could be taken that have to come from our leadership. I think Americans are people of energy, action, ideas, and great flexibility. I'd like to see an 800 number and a website for ideas from the public. We're very, very creative out here.
Mm-hmm.
I think we like plain speaking, honesty, and action, and I'd like to suggest a scenario. Suppose our leaders had suggested that in the interests of public health and home safety, we all get fit immediately, lose weight immediately. There'd be long-range payoff both in health care costs and short-range payoff in public confidence as people got more fit.
So, Tony, you're ready to hit the treadmill for national security.
Not only the treadmill. I have 25 ideas within the first hour of this atrocity on 911, and I've written them to as many people in our leadership and the media as possible.
Tony, what do you think about...
It's incredible to me that people do not see the opportunities that are presented here for really turning the public energy and confidence and entrepreneurial characteristics, as well as our tolerance, to a really national and international good.
God, good. We've got it. Tony, thanks very much for your call. You know, there has been the Pentagon program, which opened up an invitation, a general invitation to Americans to give proposals on new technologies and security measures that might help fight terrorism at large. But what about the mobilization of the public, Ernest May? What's the historical record in terms of the effectiveness and how vigorously governments in the past have gone at that as a way of bolstering national security?
Well, again, to take the example of World War II, it certainly happened then. And in fact, if you look at the war mobilization effort, it was not going very well before the creation of OWM in 1943. Once that was created and the government began to get its act together, people cooperated in ways in which they simply had not been doing before.
Such as?
Well, the most obvious case is we faced a critical shortage of rubber. Gasoline rationing was introduced not because we had a shortage of gasoline, but because it was designed to save rubber. And initially...
So just drive less, don't wear your tires
now.
That's
right.
Wow.
It was... And people recognized that that was true, and you had initially a lot of people objecting on the ground. They knew that there was not a gasoline shortage.
Mm-hmm.
But when it was explained that this was the problem, and the problem was to save rubber, people understood that, and they did, in fact, abide by it.
And 30 years later, my great-grandmother's back room was still full of tin cans
right.
that she had squashed
right.
and saved, even after the war was over.
Right.
What do you think now? President Bush and the administration have so far not called that deeply for public mobilization. Is there more that could or needs to be done?
Well, again, it has to be part of a plan. It can't be just something that's called for without being specific. You'd have to be told what you needed to do and where you'd go to do it. And that, I think, for example, with regard to bioterrorism, there's a lot of that. There's a lot that people could do to learn about what they could do, to learn about what they could do to be paramedics of one kind or another. If they were given instructions as to how to do it. But it has to be part of a plan.
We've just got another minute, but look ahead briefly for us, if you would, with the benefit of historical perspective. How do you expect this war, this battle for homeland security, to unfold in the months and maybe years ahead?
Well, ultimately, I'm pretty sure that we will get ourselves organized to deal with this in a way that will be effective. It doesn't mean we'll get rid of it forever, but it will produce a situation in which it's tolerable, in which it is no worse than the situation that people live in Northern Ireland. But the question is how long it's going to take. And if it takes years, and that's when I begin to wonder if this wonderful spirit of the country that we see now can really
survive that.
That's right. If we may not just get blue spirit.
And what's your fear just about a next major attack? What do you think the consequences might be for the government's sense of control and for the public, very quickly?
Well, there certainly is likely to be, it's possible that the system will at least seem to snap. I worry about that quite a lot.
That's a big enough fear to go out on, but we also hear your advice on how to pull it together, and we thank you for that. Professor Ernest May is a professor of history at the Kennedy School of Government. Thanks for joining us. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, pressing for peace at a time of war. Public opinion polls show that the overwhelming majority of Americans support the military campaign in Afghanistan. But as special coverage correspondent Jonathan Saltzman reports, the peaceniks haven't given up their fight to wipe out terror without bombs.
These in red are all new messages. These are messages from last night that I In a modest house decorated with Nicaraguan art and heated with a wood stove, Richard Walton starts his morning as he often does, turning on his home computer and reading emails from fellow peace activists.
This group, Port Side, it takes its name because port means left. And they've sent
Hollywood couldn't cast someone better for the role of a veteran peace activist than the 73-year-old resident of Warwick, Rhode Island. With his long white beard and denim overalls, Walton bears a strong resemblance to the principled grandfather in the TV show that, coincidentally, bore his last name. An adjunct English instructor at Rhode Island College, Walton has been a peacenik, as he describes himself, for more than 30 years. He protested the Vietnam War, America's proxy wars in Central America, and the Persian Gulf War. In January, he was part of a group that went to Iraq with former Attorney General Ramsey Clark to decry UN economic sanctions there. For the past two Fridays, Walton has organized a vigil closer to home outside the main post office in downtown Providence. He says the few dozen protesters believe the Bush administration has made a horrendous mistake by bombing Afghanistan.
It seems to me that whenever there is a complex problem in the world, instead of addressing the complexity of the problems, the United States says, let's bomb them. And that's what we're doing now. I don't think we're truly addressing terrorism. What we are addressing is our psychological need to do something, anything.
Walton says the military campaign will only increase resentment of America in the Islamic world and sow the seeds of more terrorism. Peace activists often face a daunting task, especially at the start of a war when patriotic fervor runs high. But Walton finds the challenge even greater in this war because the TV images of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon were so ghastly.
Almost every American above the age of two or three or so has seen this over and over again. So we have a sense of being violated that we have not had in the past. So the fact that it happened in front of our eyes, that millions of us saw it happening live, that has had a psychological impact on the American public that I don't think any of the stuff in the past did, which makes our job all the more difficult because of the perfectly valid sense of violation, of anger, even rage.
There's never been a war involving America from the Revolutionary War onward that hasn't drawn at least some opposition. The current conflict is no exception, although public opinion polls show the vast majority of Americans support the military campaign in Afghanistan. However, some longtime peace activists, including those who consider themselves pacifists, acknowledge that the terrorist attacks have pushed them to the limits of their beliefs. The Reverend Alan Sinaki, a Buddhist priest who lives in Berkeley, California, says he's still committed to the principles of nonviolence. He believes the United States is wrong to bomb Afghanistan, but he concedes that he's struggling to figure out how America should respond to the terrorist attacks.
The difficulty is in knowing what to do. And I will have to admit that that's something that I'm still every day trying to learn about, trying to understand, reading just hungrily commentaries, analyses, books. And I have a sense of what I might like to see or what course I might like to see, but I can't stand on it absolutely. What I can stand on is a pretty strong belief that violence engenders more violence and that hatred engenders more hatred.
One view shared by many peace activists is that the Bush administration erred by immediately characterizing the terrorist attacks as an act of war. Joe Volk heads a group that lobbies Congress on behalf of Quakers. He says the Bush administration's approach only raised the standing of the terrorists in the Muslim world.
The people who committed the terrorist act in New York, in Pennsylvania, and here in Washington, D.C. at the Pentagon, were murderers, mass murderers. But by the president declaring war with them, they got not only what they wanted, a war with the United States, but standing on the international stage as international players. Our response, on the contrary, should name them for what they are, criminals, and keep them at that level, not allow them to be players on the international stage.
Volk became a Quaker in 1982, 14 years after he was court-martialed by the Army for refusing to fight in the Vietnam War. He says the Quaker faith, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1947 for its commitment to nonviolence, maintains that no war is just because every country at war feels it's in the right. Instead of bombing Afghanistan, Volk says, the United States should have tried to bring the terrorists responsible for the September 11th attacks to justice in an international court. Critics find that idea noble but misguided. For one thing, the ruling Taliban government in Afghanistan refused to hand over Osama bin Laden to the United States. Moreover, says Northwestern University law professor Stephen Lubit, the terror attack on the World Trade Center was no ordinary crime and can't be handled by the criminal justice system.
A criminal court, domestic or international, deals with crimes individually. It's a retail system that takes years to bring even a single individual to account. And it's completely inadequate for the purpose of incapacitating an enemy that has attacked and seems quite determined to continue attacking.
That's not to say the United States shouldn't prosecute those who coordinated the terrorist attacks, Lubit says, but that can only happen after the military operation. Many peace activists say the United States should focus more on trying to understand the roots of terrorism and what drove 19 men to become suicide bombers. They say the terrorist attacks were despicable, but contend that American imperialism, oppression, and violence has fostered terrorism. Other activists said the United States should have used a more unorthodox approach after September 11th to prevent more terrorism. Jonathan Vogel-Bourne, the field secretary for the New England Yearly Meeting of Friends, or Quakers, says the United States' response could have been modeled on the martial art Aikido. The government could have taken the evil committed by the terrorists and transformed it into good.
What could we have done would have been to do a massive humanitarian aid for Afghanistan and to try and win hearts and minds earlier on, not, you know, throw down humanitarian aid from airdrops and at the same time be bombing. That's quite a double message going on there. We want you to eat, but we're going to kill you, okay?
Back in his house, Richard Walton, the veteran of numerous peace movements, says a lot of people may dismiss the arguments of peace activists. Walton acknowledges that some folks may even call him a woolly-headed left-wing academic.
But if I may offer a defense, these woolly-headed academics were against the war in Vietnam. The woolly-headed academics were against American intervention in Central America. We said that terrible things were being done in El Salvador and Nicaragua. Whenever so, oh, no, 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 that couldn't be. The United States doesn't do that kind of stuff. So far, the woolly-headed academics have a higher batting average than the hawks.
Walton plans to continue holding vigils and hopes more people join him. I'm Jonathan Saltzman.
For continuing coverage, as well as background information on all types of bioterrorism threats, go to our website at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.